Swiss banks stand accused of collaborating with the Nazis. But it wasn't just Swiss bankers who dealt with Hitler's Reich. New evidence shows that many who financed him came from uncomfortably closer to home.
The notion that the Swiss are the primary collaborators of the Germans is to me absurd. The emphasis, I think, is misplaced. Were the Swiss admirable in all respects? Probably not, but who was?
While war raged, there were British and American bankers who continued to do business with the Nazis.
In the beginning of the war, people didn't know who would win. I guess they wanted to hedge. If in fact Germany won the war, they wanted access to the other side.
They were terribly cynical people who felt that the war would end as all wars do, and they would go right back to business as usual.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt Library at Hyde Park, New York, records of the president's term in office are stored. Among the many papers are the diaries and records of Henry Morgenthau, Roosevelt's Secretary of the Treasury. Morgenthau's diaries reveal an astonishing story of how both national and commercial banks created a system which helped finance the Nazis. The 20th century brought with it global finance and the need for governments to settle huge debts. Traditional bank clearing systems simply could not process the volume of transactions. To solve this problem, German economist Hjalmar Schacht masterminded a new bank, the Bank for International Settlements, based in Basel, Switzerland. The BIS, as it was known, would be the central bank to Europe's national banks, such as the Bank of England and Germany's Reichsbank. Together with the Bank of Japan, the great national banks of Europe opened an account at BIS and settled their debts by gold and credit transfer. For Germany, it would be a mechanism for paying its huge First World War reparations.
The BIS was a bank set up in 1930 to help transfer reparations. The bank was used to intermediate between the Germans paying reparations and the Allies receiving it. And then it became useful as a club of central bankers in Europe who would get together once a month and discuss their common interests.
The board of the BIS was made up of member nations who held a share in the bank and was supported by a team of economists.
My father, Per Jacobson, was appointed as economic advisor. This was a revolutionary step. Central banks didn't have economists on them in those days.
As a young economics student in Basel, Aaron Jacobson came to know BIS board members as friends of the family, including one of the most important, Montague Norman, governor of the Bank of England. Norman was also a close personal friend of Hjalmar Schacht.
Both used instinct, as did my father. Their economics was based on the instinct they had. and they sort of knew what was around the corner. They had the same job, and you know, if someone has much the same job as you do, you can talk to them in a different way to some outsider. Well, I can't remember ever hearing that there'd been something that had caused more than a slight discussion. They were on the same sort of line through thick and thin.
In 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. He appointed Schacht as head of the Reichsbank and Nazi representative at the BIS. Hitler said of Schacht,
"It was his consummate skill at swindling other people which made him indispensable at the time. After all, seeing that the whole gang of financiers is a bunch of crooks, what possible point was there in being scrupulously honest with them? Before each meeting of the International Bank at Basel, half the world was anxious to know whether Schacht would attend or not. It was only after the assurance that he would be there that the Jew bankers of the entire world packed their bags and prepared to attend. In spite of his ability, I could never trust Schacht, for I had often seen how his face lit up when he succeeded in swindling someone out of a 100-mark note."
Schacht, of course, was a complicated fellow. He was sometimes being a central banker, sometimes being a Nazi, sometimes being an anti-Nazi. If you read his work, he's all over the place.
It was Schacht's job to arrange finance for the building of the Third Reich. The BIS channeled investments from the Allied powers into Germany for the expansion of her economy. Although after 1933 there were no new investments, existing investments were renewed annually and paid into Hitler's Reich. By 1939, 294 million gold Swiss francs had been channeled into the German economy. Schacht's economic priority became the rearmament of Germany. Through the BIS, the Allies had been investing in an economy gearing itself for war.
History Viewpoint will continue in a moment on History.
In America, the danger of the growing BIS was realized by Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau. He shared with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt a suspicion of the banking community.
There was a considerable feeling against Wall Street at that time on the part of the new Democratic Party, which formed itself around Roosevelt. It was the first time in some years that the Secretary of the Treasury had not been a banker. Morgenthau was loyal to the president to an nth degree, and they had a remarkably close personal relationship. But he didn't understand the intricacies of international finance, foreign exchange. The principal concern of everybody was getting out of the Depression. The international fear of a war coming in Europe was there in some people, but it was not a predominant feeling in political circles. But Morgenthau was always watching American trade with Germany.
Even though he was a political person, I believe in many cases his principles came first. As far as Nazi Germany was concerned, nothing moved him more deeply than his hatred of Nazi Germany, because of what it stood for. Morgenthau felt that we shouldn't cooperate in any way with a country of that kind. Or I don't think this ever occurred to people who dealt with them in terms of their international financial relations.
Gefallen. Ein Volk hat zueinander gefunden.
When the Nazis annexed Austria in the spring of 1938, Morgenthau's fears that the BIS could be used as a tool of imperialism proved right. One of Germany's first acts was to demand that the gold held in Austria's name at the BIS be transferred to the vaults of Hitler's Reichsbank. The BIS as servant of its central banks, dutifully transferred 22 tons of gold.
They were interested in maximizing the profits of their commercial banks, carrying out financial policies and economic policies of their countries. They probably didn't think there was in their province to be guided in any way by the nature of the country that they were dealing with.
On March 16, 1939, Montague Norman was still espousing the virtues of the BIS.
The BIS, whose monthly meetings in Switzerland provide invaluable opportunities of contact, started in the difficult times of 1930, but already has fully shown its worth and will surely prove it in the future.
As he spoke, Hitler's troops were occupying Czechoslovakia. Again, the Nazis demanded Czechoslovakia's gold, just as they had done with Austria's. But this time there was a problem. Much of Czechoslovakia's gold had been shipped to a safe haven, the Bank of England. Unfortunately, some of it was in a BIS account at the bank.
The Nazis wanted to take over the Czech gold to bolster their foreign income. I was told the governor and his senior colleagues were had up at pistol point and said, if you don't authorize this transshipment of the gold, you've had it.
The directors of Czechoslovakia's National Bank were ordered to contact the BIS and demand that their BIS gold be transferred to the Reichsbank. Because the gold was in England, the BIS called Britain's central bank and informed Montague Norman at the Bank of England of the Czech instruction. Like the BIS, Norman saw no way of stopping the transfer. But by the rules of the BIS, Montague Norman had the power to delay the transfer if he did so by the end of the day when all banking transactions had to be completed. But Norman took no action, and £6 million worth of gold was credited to the Reichsbank. When the Bank of England's actions became known, they caused uproar in the Houses of Parliament.
The Bank of England, after what has happened, may no longer be looked upon as the safest place in the world, and the phrase, safe as the Bank of England, may no longer apply.
The Bank for International Settlements is the bank which sanctions the most notorious outrage of this generation, the rape of Czechoslovakia.
In Washington, Morgenthau and his team tried to piece together the Czech gold affair.
The Treasury had a lot of information and contacts coming in from these five or six top Treasury people in the embassies. The one in London, whose name was Butterworth, knew everybody in the banking community in London and knew his business, and his reports were important.
Well, you've read Butterworth's cable on Czech gold. When you boil it all down, this is what I get out of it. That almost £6 million of BIS gold was transferred. It's of interest to us because a year ago we took the position that might happen and we didn't want to deal with the BIS. Well, it's a dirty business, whichever way you look at it.
By that summer, Europe was preparing for war. In Basel, the BIS took its own actions to protect itself and appointed a neutral to head its bank, an American banker based in London, Thomas McKittrick.
Mr. McKittrick came from Lee Higginson in London. He did tell me how much he enjoyed life in London, where he had a maid who ironed his pajamas every night. And I think he had the butler warm the Times before he read it. But that's life of the upper classes in London, I guess. I think he was regarded as somebody who was a placeholder. You put a man who's an American, a neutral, B, just trying to keep the place alive.
McKittrick was a lawyer, not an economist. And his main job was keeping the bank intact as an institution. He was an expert on flowers. And he and I used to go walking in the mountains. And he taught me about botany. I knew nothing. I became quite a little expert. He had a quiet sense of humor, but he was, you know, all that you'd expect an uncle to be.
With the invasion of Poland, war in Europe broke out. When Holland and then Belgium fell, the Reichsbank looted their gold, giving Hitler more money for more weapons, for more war. Some of that gold found its way to the BIS. But even while British and French soldiers were being driven back to Dunkirk, the Bank of England's position did not change on the BIS. Its constitution gave it diplomatic immunity.
La désignation des ports devra tenir compte des ports d'attache du temps de paix.
In June 1940, the citizens of Paris learned of their country's defeat.
When Paris fell in 1940, I decided that it was time to get out of Basel. Either the war would be short and the Germans would win, in which case I wouldn't want to be there, or the war would be long, and in which case I wouldn't want to be there. And my wife was pregnant, and so we went to one doctor, an older man. He said, don't travel. So we went to his nephew, a younger obstetrician. He said, travel. So as is often the case, if you get two conflicting opinions, you take the one you want.
McKittrick officially suspended board meetings for the duration of the war. He and the economic advisor of the bank went to live at Rougemont, 100 miles from Basel.
A friend of his owned the castle, and McKittrick had permission to use it. I went and counted the number of beds in the servants' wing, and there were 22. And we had a staff of 6 plus one chauffeur.
During the war, enemy nationals were ordered not to fraternize, but at the BIS, old friendships died hard.
A technical show was made of keeping the Allies on one side and the Germans on the other side, but of course it never worked out. They just sort of mixed up and walked across the room and said, now, Hans, how did you get on when you were doing and had your new baby come and all these things? And, you know, you wouldn't have known a war was on.
Even after America's entry into the war in December 1941, McKittrick's presidency of the bank went unchallenged by Nazi officials. More disturbingly, reports were coming through to Washington that Montague Norman and his good friend Hjalmar Schacht, now Reichsminister without portfolio, were making contact about a separate peace. On July 25, 1942, Roosevelt cabled Churchill.
I think the Prime Minister should know that from a Madrid source, word is being sent that Montague Norman is establishing contacts with Schacht with regard to peace feelers.
Winston Churchill to Eden, 26 July.
Foreign Secretary, I cannot believe such a thing, that either you should see him or I.
Eden to Churchill, 29th July.
Prime Minister, I have seen Montague Norman, who states emphatically that he has had no communication of any kind with Schacht for more than a year.
Churchill to Eden, 31st July.
Foreign Secretary, we have been at war for over 2¾ years. Can he extend his assurance to cover the whole period?
No assurance to Churchill appears in the file. Nevertheless, Eden cabled Washington, insisting that no contact had taken place between Schacht and Norman during the war. Without documentation, it isn't possible to know definitely whether they were in touch. Meanwhile, in public, McKittrick went through the facade of addressing the annual meetings of the BIS in an empty boardroom to prove that the BIS board was not sitting in time of war. But away from the public gaze, McKittrick maintained contact with the board members, and Nazi, Italian, Japanese, and British staff of the BIS continued to meet and do business. Throughout the war, Germany was drawing dividends on its investments in the bank, including those of some of the countries it had conquered.
It has been said that foreign exchange control is like sex. It's a very difficult thing to enforce. And I suppose you could go to another level and say that where an obvious profit exists anywhere, it's very difficult to prevent people from taking advantage of it. There's a drive beneath for sex or profit.
It had been put to them that the bank, for the good of the world, and remember it was open which side would win. The bank would be needed in the post-war world, and they had to behave like human beings to ensure this. I mean, the British staff and the German staff went off on these hikes. The secretaries were there, of course, and it was perfectly amicable. They didn't make a big show of going a bunch of Germans here and a bunch of British there. They intermingled, really, like normal human beings.
The staff of the BIS also enjoyed travel privileges, courtesy of the Axis powers. In 1942, BIS President Thomas McKittrick set off for the United States. Astonishingly, he returned in May 1943 via Rome with the permission of the fascist authorities, despite the fact that Italy was at war with his native America.
My father went up to Sweden, I think that was about 43. He went through Germany, and of course he always saw Mr. Pool, the Reichsbank. He asked Pool to let him go to England, and Pool said, oh, yes, do go to England. In fact, it would be very good for the BIS if you did. Poole was definitely for keeping relations with the central banks as intact as possible. He certainly sent messages to Norman through my father, saying, I hope you're all right and that, you know, you haven't been bombed out or something like that.
American intelligence also later indicated that Poole met with McKittrick to discuss attitudes in America towards Germany, and that McKittrick even traveled to Germany in 1943. The apparent closeness of BIS's relationship with the Axis powers was viewed with alarm by a growing team of U.S. Treasury investigators.
When I went to work there in the fall of 42, there may have been 14, 20 lawyers and about 100 investigators and maybe 100 auxiliary personnel. And it ended up in a very large outfit of 2,000 or 3,000 people. We were, I guess, very idealistic people. We felt that when young men and women were risking their lives and being killed in the mud in Italy, they deserved better from the folks at home and from their government.
History on History Viewpoint.
The British Treasury took a different view on the BIS. The Bank of England was continuing to receive interest from the Reichsbank on pre-war investments in Germany through the BIS. Now the Nazis had the looted gold from occupied Europe to help make the payments. In the summer of 1944, Edward Playfair defended Britain's position.
Nothing has happened to make us change our views, which are wholly different from those of the United States Treasury. It seems to me important that we should not just sit back and appear to accept their view as the right one. I saw it estimated that Axis Europe was paying around £760,000 a year in interest to the BIS and getting one-third of it back as dividends. We get the rest.
By 1944, the U.S. Treasury had a massive dossier detailing the collaborative activities of the BIS. And when the Norwegian government in exile made a formal protest about the BIS's activities, Morgenthau was ready to make his move.
At Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrived for the opening of the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference. They will work in the seclusion of this White Mountains resort.
The Norwegians had a good deal of information. It was they who introduced the resolution at the Bretton Woods Conference that the BIS should be shut down as soon as possible. Morgenthau was impressed with this. He had talked to the Norwegians, and he was impressed and convinced that this was a desirable resolution.
But not all delegates at Bretton Woods were so convinced. Representing the view of the Bank of England and British Treasury, economist Maynard Keynes went to see Morgenthau and in an off-the-record meeting argued that the BIS should not be closed down, since the bank would be needed for post-war reconstruction. While the debate over the BIS raged at Bretton Woods, the tide of war had turned against the Nazis. Allied troops had invaded Northern Europe. Within 11 weeks, they had taken Paris. Harsh treatment was meted out to the Parisians who had collaborated with the enemy. But when Morgenthau sent a treasury agent to Paris with the liberating forces, he discovered unpleasant truths about the extent of the collaboration. In December 1944, a report arrived on his desk about the activities of the Paris branch of the Chase, one of the biggest banks in America.
The Chase Paris showed itself most anxious to please the German authorities in every possible way. For example, the Chase zealously maintained the account of the German embassy in Paris, as every little thing helps. The whole objective of the Chase policy and operation was to maintain the position of the bank at any cost. I recommend that this investigation should be pressed urgently and additional personnel be sent to Paris ASAP.
In New York, Treasury agent Marjorie Farber was assigned to investigate the Chase Bank.
It had been requested by the Treasury that Chase make available all its correspondence with Paris, and I was sent there to look at it. There had been some rumors about the Chase Bank cooperating with the German industry. So perhaps that was the reason why, but anyway, that was what I was supposed to look into, whether there was anything behind it or not.
In the course of her investigations, Marjorie Farber discovered a worrying truth. In 1941, decrees were announced in France restricting the freedom of Jews. The Chase Paris took a controversial measure.
They jumped the gun. They broached the question, well, if that's the case, perhaps we shouldn't let the depositors who are Jewish, who deposit in Paris, we shouldn't let them take their money out either.
These measures taken against Jews by the Chase Paris occurred while America was at peace with Germany. A later report contextualized the actions of the Chase Paris, saying that the Chase had received a notice of the freezing of Jewish assets and believed the freeze was legally binding. The same report also confirmed that a leading member of staff at the Chase Paris had made the most of his opportunities of being nice to the German officials. U.S. Treasury investigations also cited other banks in France as having cooperated with the Nazis.
One of the banks, I don't remember whether it was Westminster or Barclay, they asked the administrator appointed by the German government whether they should keep the Jewish employees. Maybe they should throw them out or get rid of them one way or another. And his answer was, I really don't care. He's go by French regulations. I have none. Now, they didn't have to ask that, obviously. The intention was certainly to make a good impression.
In fact, a report by Farber names both Westminster and Barclays employees, acting beyond the control of their London offices, as having volunteered to the Germans that they had Jewish staff. But there is no mention in the report that they took action against Jewish assets as early as the Chase.
The banks in France had an interest in developing business with the Nazis. It was really a trade-off. They would try to provide services to the Nazis by reason of providing information. They would seek favor with them, and they would receive deposits.
Seven French banks and Barclays are being sued for any Jewish assets retained. Only Barclays are not filing to dismiss the action and are committed to returning all assets traced.
Viewpoint will continue on History Viewpoint.
When the Allies advanced across the Rhine, they discovered the fate of those who had not been lucky enough to escape. In Hitler's concentration and death camps, it was clear that the Nazis had been stripping even the most intimate assets from their victims. There were even suspicions that the Nazis were using the BIS to convert the looted possessions of camp victims into Swiss francs.
I don't think we knew what specifically the BIS was doing, but even without full proof, the U.S. Treasury was convinced that the BIS was assisting the Germans in this process, even down to looting the Holocaust victims, the teeth and gold watches and whatnot.
American intelligence reports show that the BIS permitted transfers of Nazi gold as late as April 1945. Though no evidence exists that the BIS knew the source of the gold or whether it was concentration camp loot, proof that two BIS directors handled the spoils of the Holocaust was to emerge. In March 1945, Morgenthau sent an investigator to Basel to question McKittrick.
I thought you would be interested in the attached memorandum of my conversation with McKittrick in Switzerland. I was surprised that a voluntary recital intended as a defense of the BIS could be such an indictment of that institution. I asked McKittrick why, in his opinion, the Germans had been willing to allow the BIS to run in the manner which he had described. McKittrick's explanation was as follows. There's a little group in Germany who do not share the Nazi point of view, but who are so important to the Nazis and the management of German finances that they would continue to hold important positions. I asked McKittrick, would he name any of this little group? The only person he named was Poole.
Will you state your full name?
Emil Johann Rudolf Poole.
The following year, BIS director and Reichsbank vice president Emil Poole was tried and convicted of crimes against humanity for his involvement in laundering the gold of murdered Jews from the concentration and death camps.
Killing firsthand was not his thing. He was tried primarily for two activities. One was handling the deposit of some of the grisly byproducts of the concentration camps, gold teeth, gold watches, gold pens, gold spectacle cases taken from newly created corpses in the concentration camps. So Reichsbank had vaults full of this stuff, small mountains, really. The second activity was making funds readily available to the SS for concentration camp building. And Poole, in order to make sure that the state wasn't investing its money foolishly, toured the concentration camps and made sure that they were doing what they were supposed to do.
Also tried and convicted was BIS director and Reichsbank president Walter Funk.
The head of the Reichsbank would not know that. Would you know about the 1,000 wagons of textiles that this SS man said had been shipped, or warehousing composed of the clothing of dead Jews who'd been exterminated?
In the course of the trials, some other intriguing evidence came to light.
Well, I can recall a Dresdner Bank document, which I thought was interesting, which listed American bankers favorable to the German cause. I think that was practically the heading of the document. It was a who's who of American bankers.
And the Chase was definitely on that list.
Oh, yes, the Chase was on the list. That was one of the things that caught my eye.
As the war drew to a close, Morgenthau had begun to receive reports on Nazi plans for a resurrection of Germany after her defeat, financed by investments in America and other neutral countries. His suspicions about Germany reinforced, he completed a plan which was to remain his notorious footnote in history.
Position of Morgenthau and White were that you shouldn't allow Germany to be reindustrialized. Germany should become a cabbage patch. You could have small shops and grow crops, but never become an industrial power again.
Morgenthau's plan was rejected, and in April 1945, he lost his greatest protector. After the death of President Roosevelt, Morgenthau resigned from public office, and his investigations into the banks and their collaboration with the Nazis were wound down. No further action was taken against the Chase, Barclays, or Westminster banks, and in Basel, the BIS left their old headquarters behind them, but continue to this day to do business as usual.
The important thing was to try and arrange for a decent post-war period. I mean, that's what they all saw, whichever side they were on. If you have one institution in Europe, well, you want it to stay working, be important, and really help in the post-war period, and that's what the BIS did.
According to the testimony, you said we have fallen into the hands of criminals. How could
its architect, Hjalmar Schacht, had been imprisoned by the Nazis for the last months of the war. Though acquitted at Nuremberg, in 1947 a German court sentenced him to 8 years hard labor for war crimes.
Hitler und seine Genossen.
Hitler, you know, is dead.
On appeal in 1948, he was acquitted of all charges and set up his own bank. His old friend, Montague Norman, became Lord Norman. He went down in history as the longest-serving governor of the Bank of England. McKittrick resigned from the BIS at the end of the war and returned to America to become vice president of the Chase Bank. Emil Poole was released after serving just 4 years and 7 months in prison. And in 1954, he applied for a visa to America. He gave his visa reference as the Chase Bank. The American Consulate General wrote, commenting on his war crimes record,
"It should be noted that the Consulate General has, in the course of its examination, found no other grounds which would prevent Mr. Poole from receiving a non-immigrant visa. Mr. Poole is one of the outstanding bankers in Germany and wishes to proceed to the United States on the invitation of several well-known American bankers to participate in discussions of some importance."
Documents that might show whether Poole entered the United States remain classified.
They were going to be on the right side no matter what happened. Banking is banking. And that these fellows were interested in having a nice, peaceful relationship. German, British, didn't matter to them. A nice, peaceful relationship with everybody making money.
Those who fought the bankers did not fare so well.
Our American way of life, which has flourished under our republic, and has nurtured...
The war against Nazism was over. The war against communism had just begun. Harry Dexter White, Morgenthau's second-in-command, was accused of being a communist. He suffered a fatal heart attack while under investigation in 1948.
White was only one person on whom self-confessed communist agents informed.
Other members of Morgenthau's team were also accused, and his administration became tainted with communism.
They were all given a terrible thrashing by the House Un-American Committee, and years later by McCarthy. Mr. Morgenthau, I think, felt betrayed. And, of course, I was so saddened to see him in the last years of this very great and prominent life in which he had earned so many kudos. I was very sad to see him feel that way, and I would say, oh, they never proved anything about this one, and they never proved anything about that one. It's just that all of these poor people, some of whom were the most brilliant economists in the world, their lives were destroyed.
Morgenthau spent the last years of his life building up an archive to preserve the truth for future generations.